Welcome to Diving Into the Wreckage, and it's today Sean Fack, and we have our old broader topics, and I have a strange feeling we're going to be back on our more controversial bin. Weirdly, the parapolitics episode wasn't all that controversial, I guess because I, like, 75% agree with the presumptions, but I don't tend to be a conspiracy theorist, which has made me an odd man out these days as parapolitics, aka speculating on what you cannot know.
Right. Nothing cannot change.
Yeah. You cannot know and you cannot change has become a way for certain kinds of populists. Let's look at Sean McCarthy and Nagel to do their, I'm not even going to call them left populist anymore, even though they're anti-capitalist. I think giving them even that moniker is unfair to less populist, but nonetheless, you see what they're doing. Both on the right and the left.
The advantage of it, of course, is that it's both unknowable and impossible to change. So it's great fodder for the discourse, right?
Right. And also it flatters people. That's the third thing. It flatters people's intelligence to make them think that they see through something, but it's something that has a folk etymological understanding. You don't have to have a complex structural understanding of anything to understand it. Like if Zog actually exists, then the banking problem and the geopolitical problems of a declining empire really is just the Zionist run government.
Sure. Absolves us of all responsibility, that's for sure.
Yep, it even kind of absolves the American empire of irresponsibility and why Israel would have been crucial to it in the first place, which is geographic. There's a reason why that area produced so many religions, but also has been, I mean, you know, not to bemoan the poor Palestinians because I don't want to, but there's a reason why an area that is as farmland, pretty useless. I mean, you can grow olives on it, but as an area for massive amounts of production, kind of unstable until the modern period, and still largely is dependent on refining technologies, not producing the key elements of, because there's not enough minerals and stuff for them to do it internally. No, it makes sense as the gateway between Asia and Africa to be something you want to control if you want to control military trade.
Yes.
You know, because that still largely has to go by land. I mean, the kinds of equipment that you need to go through. And when that changed with the development of massive aircrafts, it's still geostrategically important, because if you've ever been to Egypt or Israel, you know it's 3 hours from anywhere. Mm-hmm. I can go by airplane, I can go from Egypt, and I did this, to Germany, to Dubai, to the lower part of Ethiopia, to Tunisia, like to Spain, to Greece. It's kind of, from the standpoint of the Eurasian African land masses, super important. Now, from the standpoint of production, not so much. And I know Marxists have a hard time dealing with that, but it is just a geostrategic reality.
Well, certainly one thing that's necessary for production over the last couple hundred years is energy inputs. And obviously, geostrategically, it's in a great position as an unsinkable aircraft carrier to impose some sort of dominance over that region, which, even if the United States and its empire doesn't directly control the oil, it's important that it be accessible across global markets, and it's important that they're not being marked against U.S. power.
Not just us, which is why Russia and China will do rhetorical stuff against Israel, but they won't do anything actually.
Right.
And it's why China is Israel's second largest trade partner, or largest, depending on which stats I looked at that given day.
If you want to continue courting controversy, or if you want to court more controversy than you did the last time we did a Diving Into the Wreckage, we can stay on Israel for a while. I feel like this is going to be maybe a kaleidoscopic, let's say, episode for you and I, because I think it's been months. It has been months since you and I have podcasted together. Mm-hmm. And kind of the point of this reunion, let's call it, was to kind of pick up a lot of threads that you and I were, playing around with for the last several years, including the debt crisis. Remember, you and I had a whole series on that entire thing.
Which is back with a vengeance. And
we were catching it and it's a rising tide. And now we're about to see a flood, perhaps. So that's one thing that we want to talk about. Sorry, go ahead.
There's a ton of stuff. There's other stuff I said I've been thinking about. But Israel's maybe the place to start because it's where it's where the material realities of a lot of the left actually start to fall apart. These two major war spheres, which are not the only ones. I mean, we have Ethiopia basically saying that Israel and Russia have proven that no one's going to help them if they decide to genocide Eritrea. That happened yesterday. I saw it yesterday in the news. We have seen a general development of increased conflicts, not all of which are proxy conflicts. Armenia and Azerbaijan is not really a proxy conflict between Russia and the West because it was Russia keeping it Russia keeping both sides at bay. What we've seen is these multipolar, a term that I've seen fall out of favor on the and left discourse so very quickly, amazingly so, actually.
Well, I mean, a lot this can relate to Israel. Mm-hmm. Israel is obviously a cause celeb now, and it's gaining traction as such. Because there's a civil war within both the right and the left right now about how the United States government, how our state relates, how our politics relates to Israel. But, you know, one thing that struck me about the last, let's call it 10 years, 5 to 10 years, right, is that you and I are both, let's just say, like amateur students of history. You're more professional than I am, but we're students of history, right? I think mm-hmm. that what we've endeavored to do on this program, on this collaboration, what you endeavor to do on your program, and what Andy and I have endeavored to do, whether successfully or not, on this wreckage, is attempt to kind of try to create some coherence out of these broader historical kind of fluxes that are happening to us right now, these historical structures. And it felt like through the 2000s and the 20-teens, that there was some coherence there. Perhaps that coherence was false, and perhaps it fooled us into thinking that an era of coherence would continue. Or maybe that coherence was such that it seemed as though a potential incoherence that would arise out of various economic and political imperial crises might actually engender something with more revolutionary coherence to it. As it turns out, this era feels, the last 5 to 10 years feels very, very incoherent, to the point where issues, not Israel because it's still in the news, but certainly assassinations, various other geopolitical things happening in Europe, cultural things keep bubbling to the surface and then disappearing just as quickly as they arrived. It's really hard to hold on to anything right now. Anything that doesn't have the impact of, say, the Israel Gaza war or the Russo-Ukrainian war, or at least the longevity of those things. It seems like as soon as they arise politically and they arise in our consciousness, they disappear again. And that's part of, I think, like a larger unfolding incoherence that we might have predicted 10 years ago or so. But now that we're in it, I think leaves at least me very disoriented a lot of the times, unsure what it is that's going on right now in the world, in the news, that's important to grasp a hold to, and what is simply ephemeral and what might pass through. It makes you think that these great histories, say, of the 1960s, where we have these coherent events, the, you know, desegregation of schools, you have the JFK assassination, the Civil Rights Act, the assassination of Martin Luther King, you have May 68, all these things, growing up, or at least, you know, throughout our adult lives, have had some coherence that we've been able to impose on them in the past. But it really makes you, makes me anyways, feel like I don't really have a true sense of like what it was like to live through that period, because we cut our teeth on like the 90s and the 2000s, which as it turns out were relatively stable periods. That's a large, big digression from Israel. But I think the point stands that like we're in this moment of flux right now, and American politics and its relation to Israel is part of that flux, to the extent that I'm not sure what sort of structures are operative. And I'm not even sure what sort of events right now are going to be important moving forward, and which ones will just bubble up to the surface and disappear. I don't know if you have similar feelings to that.
I do. To respond to that for me is to say, I have seen some of the grand movements that we see now coming for 20 years, even when I was not a Marxist. The end of the Bush administration was such a traumatic experience for me that looking at the implications of that led me to look into a much longer history, which led me to think that one, that all the predictions by the left, I mean, and people forget this, but you have Baudrillard giving lectures in like 2001, 2002, that there was no business cycle anymore. And we've seen this again, you know, with various modern monetary theorists, with Keynesians, with left populists, you know, Seth Ackerman arguing that inflation doesn't hurt the poor at one point over at Jacobin magazine in 2022. Because the business cycle has effectively been tamed. You've had people make ersatz para-academic careers out of that. And it's been disorienting to me in a few analytic cases. So, for example, trying to figure out what the overproduction of elites means, not just in a national context, but like Peter Turchin and the people who actually do this analysis, they just look at nations. Turchin hints at it being a larger problem than a national one, but all of his number sets are national and it's a problem. And on the left, we've seen the rise of methodological nationalism just becoming a form of nationalism. Mm-hmm. That's like generally the way the left approaches it. You see this in Bernie Sanders. You see this in the Social Democrats. The people who condemned Angela Nagel in 2019, 2020, I don't think we're wrong to do so. She actively misrepresented Marx, but she was perfectly consistent with the implicit implications of Bernie's politics. Mm. And now that Bernie is trying to pull people from the Trump coalition, that has been made abundantly clear. Mm. You know, going on the Tim Dillon show and saying Trump is right about immigration and Biden was wrong, when Biden actually maintained most Trump era immigration policies from Trump one. Even though Bernie is not actively saying that we should have these indiscriminate ICE raids, he's giving cover to it, whether he tries to nuance it or not, particularly given the audience that he's trying to appeal to. I mean, it's not just now that the mainstream of the Democrats are doing Trumpism with a human face.
Mm.
The left populists and progressives are doing Trumpism with a human face.
Mm.
Which tells you something about the national form. Now, the reason why this has been confusing to me is the other thing I've been trying to work out is I've had assumptions about profitability for a long time. I have assumed that anthropically, that there was a tendency of the rate of profits to fall before I even knew about it in Marx.
Mm.
I got it from Nouriel Roubini.
Mm. All right. Very good reading in like 2007, 2008, 2009.
Right. I read him in 2006. After in 2005, I started pondering the nonsensical economics of the debt market for housing in 2005. Mm. All right. Like, why were you making such a prime asset holding, like, an investment item? And what we saw after 2009, which is going to make some people really sad about this next downturn, is what became the investment item moved from the house, which was a way to accumulate wealth in post-Fordist societies. But never. If you actually look at its asset growth versus asset growth in the market, it was never a true asset holding.
Mm.
Particularly if you lived in it, because you can't valorize it. You can't sell it. If you live in it, you cannot sell it and get the money from it without having to buy another home, which means you're then resubject to the market. So it's not a valorizable form of wealth. It is a, in some ways, fictitious form of wealth. Mm-hmm. It is only non-fictitious when you move to valorize it. All right. So I realized that. And what I've noticed is in the shift of the economy to move towards rents, which is something that capitalists try to do all the time. But the tech industry was able to use monopsony power to make possible during the quantitative easing period. We saw it look like that they finished, that they had figured out the business cycle. But even back in Trump 1, there was indications that that was weakening. There was a sharp and shocked reset throughout the global chain, which we avoided by basically asset inflation. In the United States, it hit everywhere else. There's a 2022 recession pretty much everywhere but the US. I mean, it even hit China. China's GDP went down to like 3.5 for a couple months in 2023. Yeah, I think 2022, 2023, somewhere in there.
Yeah, what passed a recession in China?
Yeah, which is not a true recession, but it's about as close as they get right now. And it proved...
Dissession. I just made up a term. Dissession.
It also proved that China has a business cycle, which says a lot, actually. I bring all this up because it is related to Israel, believe it or not.
Yeah.
All these societies, not just the West, all of them, want Israeli surveillance tech that they developed on the Palestinians. The frontiers are where a lot of this stuff develops, frontiers and wars. I mean, even if you look at like the history of American innovation, most of it was either NASA or the military, and then privatized and sold to corporations later. We don't have a lot of market innovation historically in the US. Not to say that there isn't any, but there's not a ton. They don't do market. There's no market incentives to do primary research. So if you look like the development of the internet for the military, development of the satellite technology, military, development of, airplanes, actually, even though it was private at first, military. It unfortunately is where a lot of late capital R&D comes from. That was not true in the 19th century. There was a lot more actual development from corporations in the 19th century during the height of expanding industrialization, which made the things that you got in the 20th century by the government a lot more possible. But so I don't want to say that the markets have never innovated, but they haven't innovated in a long time. And this goes back to like Bukharin writing on the monopoly capital. This is one of the reasons why everyone's so invested in only superficially opposing Israel. And the other reason is they have 29 nukes.
Yeah, enough for each capital in Europe and probably one for Washington, D.C. if they felt like it. And something that they have threatened before in the past. Obviously, we're all familiar with the Samson option. I think what's become very clear on Israel, maybe it's not clear to everybody, is that there's not an explicit policy of genocide and ethnic cleansing, that war crimes are winked at from the top, but not directed from the top, that a lot of the most terrible things that we've seen over the last couple of years have been a reflection of a kind of spontaneous and democratic sort of genocide that you can only get when you have a conscription army like Israel has, with middle ranking commanders, I think, oftentimes giving the go ahead for war crimes, while there's plausible deniability at the top for these things. All of this leading to something much darker than this vision of like the Zionists directing murder sprees and murder campaigns, but actually especially the right wing, the Mizrahi, like the kind of settler right wing of Israel, and their political power at their base, being empowered to do what they wish violently upon the people, not only of Gaza, but also of the West Bank as well. So I think that the Israel story is actually darker than even the many of the anti-Zionists want to perceive it or claim it to be. It's really like a democratic ethnic cleansing, which I think is maybe something that we are not prepared to reckon with at this date, but perhaps we'll be forced to reckon with as Gaza is presumably going to be opened up to international reporters sometime in the next year or so, unless, of course, the war comes back into force, which is always a possibility.
Oh, good luck on getting Hamas to totally disarm, even if they agreed to it.
Yeah, I mean, good luck getting Israel to even follow the dictates of the Trump administration. If it truly wants to go back to war, of course, it'll find a way to do so. And I shouldn't even use the term war, because what's happened there is not a war. I don't know. My thoughts are very grim on what's happening there. And I think that as much as there's a reckoning happening right now within U.S. politics, the power of the Israeli state, the power of the alliance, let's call it, between the U.S. and the Israeli ruling class, I think that more than that, even, Israel is kind of a harbinger, a potential harbinger of what the frontier is going to look like in the 21st century. And it's going to look ugly.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, we're already seeing things turn ugly here. I mean, not only has it been ICE going after people, we've learned that it's been Border Patrol. Border Patrol is used to operating in essentially a lawless area that has been increasingly expanded through the entirety of the country. Mm-hmm. When the entirety of the country is the border, you're actually claiming that that the entire country is not under the purview of its own law. And we see that actively. I mean, this is not something that began with the Trump administration. The expansion of border of border policing began with 9/11. It began with the Patriot Act. It began with all that stuff. So when people, you know, like our neoconservative friends, and for those of you listening, that's in air quotes. Mm-hmm. Who found the way, we have to remember that they mostly set up the regime that enabled Trump to do a lot of this. Now, the other person who set up the regime that enabled Trump to do a lot of this that leftists don't want to look at is FDR.
Mm.
And it's FDR's war powers. Mm. Now, FDR, for example, his special tariff powers was actually to reduce tariffs, not to increase them. He pegged them to other countries as an incentive to bring them down, which Trump actually, you know, said he was doing, but was totally a lie. We have seen so many different groups turn to nationalism as a way out.
Mm-hmm.
As these nations are getting actually weaker and weaker and have less and less state capacity. That's not just here. You know, there are exceptions. I mean, China has like a surveillance state, but the U.S.'s massive surveillance state is not because the government has the capacity to do all this. They have to outsource it to these tech giants that they created through tax incentives and quantitative easing.
Right.
So when you look at that, you look at a couple other things. The valuation of NVIDIA, which is a disproportionately high proportion of the U.S. stock market right now. I shared something saying it was 16%. I saw a correction that says that's actually a misunderstanding of the numbers. It's a bad math, but it's still the most percentage that one company's had. And what we're seeing is the stock portfolios are basically held up by four companies in the Magnificent Seven, and they're doing it off of revenues, and the revenues come from each other. They're passing the money around.
Right. Yeah. Classic kind of circular like internal economy that AI is doing right now. Self-dealing, we might call right. it.
We've seen AI used as a shield for other kinds of automation and outsourcing layoffs. I do not for a moment believe that most of the jobs that Amazon is getting rid of has to do with AI, and they didn't even claim so. They talked about automation, including automation in the warehouses, which is just classical robotic automation.
Mm.
which they've been doing. They just want to increase. They do seem to be wanting to use AI for some particular minor management functions, but which has always been something that I'm like, ironically, AI would be good at. The other numbers on AI replacing jobs, though, are actually interesting. There is actually no evidence that AI is the primary reason for the stagnation in the job market for young people, other than the fact that corporations have outsourced their hiring to AI, which just doesn't pass anybody through its muster. But so you have no new young positions being removed. But when you actually look at it, it's actually like only like 5 or 10% decline in hiring of junior positions. Because AI is not good at a lot of stuff.
It's not yet. And I've seen comparisons, disfavorable comparisons between the way that AI has been conceived and implemented in the United States with the LLM models, and this attempt to try to go for this moonshot of artificial general intelligence, right? That's kind of what,
which every physicist I know would take the energy of a sun to do,
right?
Well, like,
you know, and a
if
lot
it was possible at all, like if
it was possible at all, it's an open question. Whereas I've heard anecdotally, you know, because I'm not in China and we don't get a lot of reports, actually, honestly, out of what's happening in the economy of China, that in China, and not only is AI much cheaper, as we saw with the DeepSeek moment, that crisis for U.S. corporations, but also AI is not being used in order to try to fulfill this utopian dream of artificial general intelligence.
No, AI is being used to offset the demographic crisis that's going to hit China.
And it's being used directly in factories because they have a large productive capacity that they can actually use AI to try to like insert into production or insert into management of production. Whereas in the United States, you've seen what AI has been useful for, not profitable for, but useful for. And even Sam Altman admitted this has been pornography or quasi-pornography. And
cheating on your homework.
Cheating on your homework. Cheating on your job interviews. And then also, of course, to like making sort of slop content, which nobody wants and which people just make fun of to the extent that it gets views. It's because people are like, it's like the kind of views you get rubbernecking a very bad car accident, right? And so maybe like the way in which AI has been used in these different places just reflects different sort of political economies of these two places at this moment. But the point stands, I think you're right, that AI is being blamed for a lot of things. AI is being used to cover up a lot of things. It's being used as a shield for a lot of things. But like famously, I think it was in, was it 1999? Who was it that said that the effects of the computer revolution could be seen everywhere except in productivity data? Was that William Reich? It was William Reich.
Robert Reich.
Wilhelm Reich. I'm thinking of the Oregon guy, but no, the short Robert Reich, who was
what, the former Maoist who became became a part of the
Clinton administration. Yeah. Was he the Treasury Secretary?
I believe so.
Yeah, okay.
I still get annoying emails from him, so someone put me on a Democratic mailing list once. So
yeah, I mean that's a whole other fucking story. We're gonna talk about the Democrats. Maybe we'll talk about them in the second half and the Plattner, Graham Plattner, i.e. John Fetterman too, or whatever. But it's interesting to imagine what this crash is going to look like when this crash comes, because so much capital, of course, has been sunk into these data centers, which I'm not sure are there secondary uses for putting like $1 trillion of NVIDIA chips in like a big warehouse, basically, and letting them chew up electricity and water. Like, I'm not sure what's left over of that infrastructure when the inevitable crash comes. But what are your thoughts?
I have no idea. I mean, on one hand, it is compute, and you can use compute for a lot of things. On the other hand, it's incredibly expensive compute done at a time where we are also having power problems, partly out of decisions by the administration to not do things like green energy projects, which would not have contributed a lot to the power grid, but would have contributed some.
It also would have increased the sort of like general technical expertise and like created mm-hmm. This was the idea, right? I mean, I personally have a piece, or my union, I should say, has a piece of the offshore wind that's been canceled, right? So the idea was that if you could get offshore wind going, you would create a kind of virtuous cycle of self-sustaining green energy production. The private sector could step in at one point. But that, as you said, is out the window now with this new administration.
Right. One reason is it's just not super profitable. There's a variety of reasons for that. But another reason is, it's ideological. One thing that I think Marxists have had a hard time dealing with is that short-term rationality and long-term rationality are fundamentally different. And we have shifted to a short-term rationality pretty much across the board. I don't just want to say it's in the Trumpist right, which doesn't mean there aren't reasons for why they're doing stuff, but they are very short-term motivated reasons. The issue that you have, and this is going to be hard for a lot of people to accept because they've been told part of the story about currency by the MMTers that you can't run out of it. And that's true. You can't. A currency is just printed by the government. Nothing backs it up. The issue is, in lieu of anything backing it up, the international competition between states is mitigated by the bond market. And instead of a singular commodity, even oil being the thing that backs up your currency is backed up by the promises and tensions between states as manifested in that bond market. Now, most of the bond market holdings are within the U.S. That's actually part of why the economy looked decent under Biden was interest payouts. The thing is, people think of interest as just losing, but for corporations, it's not. They both lose to the cost of servicing their debts, but gain from the payouts of the debts they hold, and they do both.
Right.
Until something like the government shutdown makes liquidity a problem. Now, you could lower rate, like we're about to have a banking crisis right now. The regional banks are running out of money. They're sitting on a bunch of unrealized loans that are about to pop. And there's also a lot of injections of liquidity that aren't happening during the government shutdown. And with that being the case, that means that you actually have a weak regional banking sector, kind of similar to what you did during the debt crisis of housing in the aughts. And what people don't realize about the housing crisis is it's a debt crisis, right? It's not like a housing valuation crisis exactly. The valuation became a problem because of the debt load, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm.
So we're sitting now on a bunch of consumer loans, and even consumer loans to the 10% that's doing 90% of consumer spending right now. Credit cards look good until the government shutdown stopped them, because the consumer spending was being upheld by the upper 10% of the market,
right,
across the board. But that won't last forever, all right. And this is, again, you have leftists going around saying that temporary trends indicate a fundamental economic change because they have the memory God gave a goldfish, even if they're talking about the 15th century. For some reason, they can't look at each decade of their own. So you see a fragile market that could blow up. It could not. I mean, we also thought this might happen when the crypto banks went under.
Silicon Valley Bank, right?
Right.
Is that what you're referring to? Yeah.
And during everyone else's global meltdown, we didn't have one, but we did have that banking crisis. And for a second, it looked like that the tech industry was going to go tits up. By the way, I don't think it's insignificant that ChatGPT models began being pushed out publicly around that time.
No. In fact, as much as anything else, the AI thing feels like a huge giant put, right? By Silicon Valley, by influential actors, rich actors within Silicon Valley to try to keep the carnival going, you know, keep the casino liquid. Yeah.
That's which it did during the Biden administration, which also means, guys, that the Biden administration recovery was just as much to just Tech Valley shenanigans as the Trump economy. Right. And that was where the perception came back in, right? But we're stuck in this national loop. And because the left can't seem to, for opportunity cost reasons, and the fact that we're always dealing with fucking 20-year-olds. And I say that because, like, everyone's like, oh, don't trust the youth. I'm like, our youth don't have a frame of reference that is particularly long. That's always true. So you have lefts that have been historically dominated by the very old. Like the oligarchical problem we see in the Democrats and in the government in general, in the Western, and we see it all over the Western world, honestly. It's most terminal in the U.S. It's most obvious in the U.S. But the ages of politicians have been creaking up everywhere. Some of that is just demographics of the post-war consensus boom and the baby boomers.
And the health, the general health of the baby boom generation, and just in terms of, you know,
right,
how long they've been living and how long they've been active, been able to be active for. But yeah,
right. Right. Which I don't think we should assume will go on to the generations after it.
No, unfortunately not. Union healthcare might make it, but, you know, we destroy ourselves in other ways. So,
right. And I also think that, like, socialized medicine wasn't, for example, a good predictor of how you handled COVID at all. So it, how these different states are structured really does change how you handle crises, and we're likely to see more of them as climate continues to shift. I mean, it's just.
Yeah. I want to point out that we've added $1 trillion onto the debt, the U.S. debt, which is now at $38 trillion. The quickest, I think it's been less than a year.
Now it costs more to service the debt than to keep the military going.
Right.
Just to put that out there. Like.
Yeah, and this is obviously a compounding issue, a compounding problem, and one that the government shutdown actually hasn't really done much to affect. You know,
nope, because the sovereignty of U.S. debt isn't affected by the government shutdown by the Constitution itself. We pay when we're shut down. We have to. It's a constitutional imperative, which is why the debt ceiling's so funny, because it basically, I mean, I do think liberals are right in pointing out that it shouldn't exist. But let me tell you, there is a debt ceiling, and it's called, can you service your interest rates to keep people buying your bonds? Because if people don't buy your bonds, you're not part of the Forex bucket that backs up the global currency, and you can't trade outside of your country easily. Mm-hmm. That's the double-edged sword of modern monetary economics that people have been fucking ignoring for 10 years. And I mean, I include, there are a lot of MMTers who realize this, but I include a lot of MMTers who just been like, we don't have to worry about this. And I'm like, yes, you do. All right.
And somebody else needs to worry about the bond markets. And that's, of course, Zoran, soon to be our mayor here. When you and I were talking last week about having an episode, I said, I don't want to go too heavy with the Zoran stuff because I've been on that beat a lot. And actually, I was meant to be a member of a panel tomorrow, a platypus panel at Columbia University, alongside peers of mine, colleagues like Eric Foner, the historian, distinguished emeritus professor, who is apparently a colleague of mine, and also the Spartacus League. And it was canceled last minute by Columbia. Apparently, Eric Foner and I and the Spartacists are too dangerous, I guess. In speaking about the mayoral election, we might have brought up taboo topics like Israel, right, which is a large part of why I think Zoran has, or this particular mayor's race, has reached the national stage. But this is a long-winded way of saying that actually, now that the panel has been canceled, I have a lot of thoughts that are just kind of knocking around my head on the Zoran thing. But as I was saying, there was a great article that came out in The Baffler, I think it was today or yesterday, and I can link to it in the show notes, about municipal bond markets. You know, the fact that right now there's something like a $4 trillion state and local bond market out there that exists. One that's largely like internal to the United States. Like a lot of the investors in these bonds are American investors, right? But very quickly, as Brandon Johnson discovered in Chicago, Zoran is going to discover here in New York that there are absolutely...
And as Dennis Kucinich discovered before him, and I get really, really mad at the left populists and progressives for just actively deceiving people about this problem. That there's been no progressive mayor in the country since the development of bond markets to fund city actions that has been successful. I'm just going to just flat out say it. None. Mm-hmm. Not fucking one. And I know that people tell me Zoran does this, Zoran does that. I'm like, Zoran's trying to appease two groups of people right now. He's trying to appease the bond markets by appeasing YIMBYists. And I'll tell you why YIMBYists are a problem, even though they're all over the DSA now. They're like, you don't understand market economics. I'm like, okay. I'm not actually saying you shouldn't build. My problem is you don't want rent controls because rent controls create a market problem. And I'm going to actually say something the left also doesn't want to admit. They do. There's a reason why the rent control markets are the most expensive in the country.
There's a reason why the Bronx was burning back in the 1970s.
Right.
There's more people to set a building on fire and get the insurance for it than it was to maintain it for the residents under a rent control regime. But go on.
No, because rent control regimes, I saw this in Egypt. They have a market mechanism, but then freeze the market, which actually makes every new unit incentive to raise the price. Now, here's the MBEs are right about that. Here's what they're wrong about. They might even be lying to you about. Building buildings right now will not, in and of itself, lower rents. They won't. All right. Why? It's very fucking simple. If people ever dealt with business accounting, you can write off rent that is not paid at full value of market value, as long as you're not charging more than market rates are. Which means if you have large scale investors who can hold out for the tax rebate because they have that much liquidity, there is no incentive in the market for you to lower rents. There's an incentive not to raise them, but there is no incentive to lower them. None. Which is why they don't. Which is why in California, where you see all these YIMBYist policies being tried, what do they lead to? They lead to corporate-owned massive buildings, no public projects or anything like that that's not marketized at all. With 20% and even as low as 10% occupancy rates without a significant decline in rents. There's been a little bit of decline in California. In Utah, where they're doing it, there's been none. Now, it has kept rents from raising. The problem is, and this is true, the left don't understand their own fucking economics. They don't, right? This is Big Rock Candy Mountain shit. And the reason why it's Big Rock Candy Mountain shit is not that you couldn't do it under a socialist thing, but to do this socialism, you cannot do through capitalist policy tied to the bond market, to taxation rates, tied to business. You just can't do it.
And it's part of a larger problem, and it's part of the larger confusion we get when the word socialism gets thrown around, social democracy, democratic socialism, or whatever. It's that, like it or not, we still live under capitalism, and so there are laws of motion that impede one's ability to do things. You know, I think we as Americans, we as optimists, we who look at the federal government and the things that having the global reserve currency has allowed the federal government to spend money on, like the military, leads people to believe that like one more push, or that like one great push in a very rich city like New York, can somehow overturn the primacy of markets, overturn the necessity for there to be profits, rents, you know, gained by big developers to build in a city like New York. Even if you're going to talk about public housing, for there to be strong institutional actors who are going to profit from that public housing. And I'm thinking specifically of public housing in the 40s, 50s, 60s here in New York City, and the way that various different groups, including the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and also, of course, the MTA and the building trades unions, all managed to get a piece of this very nice and lucrative thing. So this idea that, like, market conditions no longer prevail, that you can simply build yourself municipally out of these situations, I think is a fallacy, and one that more and more people on the left, progressive left, are fooling themselves into as the results of the failures of the 20th century become more and more clear. And as the kind of circular logic that exists on the left becomes more and more pronounced, you know, I'm working right now on a very polluted waterway in New York City. Varn, have you ever heard of the Gowanus Canal?
Yeah, I have, but I don't know that much about it. I just know it exists.
It exists, and it's the most polluted body of water in the United States. It's like the Love Canal, you know, which famously was in Ohio and set on fire back in the 70s, giving environmentalists rightfully like a cause celeb to talk about pollution and our waterways or whatever. Anyways, I'm working on the Gowanus Canal right now. They intend to make the Gowanus the Venice of New York City, or at least of Brooklyn. 15, 20 years ago, I worked for a trucking company. I drove a truck, and there was a lot. And now on where that lot was, where we used to park our trucks and all the materials or whatever, is now a gleaming 20-story high-rise. A YIMBY's wet dream, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. Including, of course, for the Democratic Socialists out there, 20% mandated affordable housing, which you put your name in the lottery, and you're allowed to live in this building and use the poor door, while this rental, these rental buildings, the penthouses of them are going for, and this is rental prices, $13,000 a month. $13,000 a month for rental in next to the most polluted body of water in the entire country. So very viscerally, I'm seeing what a YIMBY, some combination of YIMBY and NIMBY future looks like, because it's mandated by Brooklyn, by the city, that they can get the zoning variance to build these giant high rises on this polluted body of water, but they can't sell them. They can't go condo. They have to remain rental. And this is apparently enough of an incentive for billions upon billions of dollars to go in to building these, and spoiler alert, empty fucking high rises that I pass through and I look at every day at work. So, like, there is a process happening right now. There is a process of development and a process of building. And there's one that's like mediated by politics as well. In New York City, the politics of rental markets, the politics of development, are very much mediated by people like Zora Mandami, by the city council, by groups like the Metropolitan Council, which is a 100-year-old civic association that represents renters in this city, right? And these are all ways, all political ways, to deal with what are these inherent contradictions, these conflicts and contradictions within the market for real estate in New York City. Needing a cheap, relatively cheap body of laborers to go to work every day to reproduce the capitalist socialization, but also developers needing to make money. And we need to be very hard-headed and realistic about what a guy like Zoran will be able to do in New York City. And I'm not just saying that to the left. The absolute... So having lived through the reign of a previous dangerous socialist mayor, one who supported the Sandinistas famously, which is Bill de Blasio, having seen his policy platform and how he implemented it, you know, I just don't see anything radically different in what Zoran is proposing. And it's bog standard capitalist politics. And maybe it's capitalist politics in an era when we're moving from a time of austerity within city politics into one of like presumed abundance. I'm not sure what it is, but the reaction to him, both on the right, fear-mongering about his Muslim background, his African and Indian background, fear-mongering, using bigotry and xenophobia, which is just really nasty, and Islamophobia, which is really nasty. Not just the right, but also the left, too, putting so much hope, so much energy into defending him and his platform, I think really shows the way in which politics has become deranged in this city and in this country. You and I promised, you know, that we'd talk about what's his name? Graham Platner.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about.
I think that, like, as much as there's a crisis and a civil war going on within MAGA right now, we would all acknowledge that there is an attendant crisis happening on the left right now. And I think it's impossible to see the energy behind Zohran as anything but a kind of a huge cope for a left, a progressive left and a socialist left that's largely lost its way in this country and has been made largely redundant, I feel like, by the MAGA movement. But what are your thoughts?
What do you mean by redundant by the MAGA movement?
I redundant might be the wrong word. Backfooted or certainly made quiescent by their inability to match the populism of MAGA and Trumpism.
But that's all fading right now, John. They're hoping, and maybe correctly.
Yeah,
the fact that left populism is not really about any of the policies that they promised at all. It's about private equity proprietary class battling the public equity proprietary class, and about shifting from imperial expansion far away to imperial expansion in our pole, which was always implicated in multipolarism. You fucking morons.
Who's they in this instance? They, you mean like the political class or the Democratic Party leadership?
No. You're talking about the right. So I'm telling you the problems of the right that's coming out right now.
Yeah.
There was you were told you were getting post-neoliberalism, but all you're getting is neoliberalism in one country, which is not really going to be any more viable than socialism in one country was, which is why you're going to see all the fractures that already existed accelerate. So the left populists think that they can ride that out, but they often think they can ride that out by just picking up their fucking talking points. So when you're talking about like the vitality of the MAGA movement, I don't think it still exists. I think living out here in Utah gives me a different perspective on you in New York. Those people are becoming at odds with each other very quickly because you can't paper over. When the demagogue actually wins, you have to deal with what the demagogue does.
If it seemed like I was ascribing some sort of coherence to conservatism or the Republican Party under the leadership of Donald Trump, I'm not sure that I wasn't trying to do that. I don't think that it's particularly coherent. All that I meant to say is just due to the political structures holding, the branches of government, the kind of momentum is on the right now, and the left is reacting to that moment.
Oh, absolutely. Here's the thing. The right now is a reactionary force, but it actually does progress things that shifts dynamics of stalled parts of the status quo. Like, for example, I talked about this with Jamie Merchant in an episode that I'm going to release way after this. It'll come out probably at the end of November. But Trumpism is a rearguard movement that almost contradictory forces things to be addressed that Democrats and centrist Republicans just fundamentally do not want to be addressed. Mm-hmm. One is how to deal with the debt traps. Hiding taxation in tariffs is a way to do that. I actually think even the Mar-a-Lago Accords was a bullshit distraction. I'm not saying people didn't believe it. But what this was about is a way to raise revenues and taxes without looking like you're raising revenues and taxes. It's a very dumb way to hide taxation, and it's an economically disastrous one in the long term. But it even baited certain leftists, and this is where you are correct, like Sean Fain, like bringing out the old Ross Perot shirt and talking about, trying to take a nuanced line on tariffs the way Bernie tried to take a nuanced line on Trump's immigration. But by nuance, I mean granting it legitimacy and then backtracking once you realize what you said. But the problem is, in both cases, they're just wrong. All right. Now, and in the case of Bernie, he's not wrong. A social democratic polity actually does need open borders. And the open versus closed borders thing is a lie. There has never been open borders between nation states.
Mm-hmm.
There was kind of one with Canada, sort of. But even that was monitored. So how open is a monitored border? You couldn't just stay here, right? But also, they're never truly closed either. An autarkic economy dies.
Mm-hmm.
An autarkic economy deals with, you know what it has to do? It has to become an empire. Otherwise, it will die. Just period. I mean, there is no such thing.
Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel's got to become an autarky, right, coming up, which might explain part of their imperial drive, but go on.
Right. No, it is. Like, where are you going to get land and resources? I mean, one of the things that tied us back to Israel, and then we can go back into Democrats, Israel has had a housing crisis and stuff for years. That's why they pushed the settler stuff. And that's why the opposition to settlerism within Israel itself became less and less popular.
Mm.
It's expensive to live in Tel Aviv.
Mm.
Like, I want to make that abundantly clear. These things are related. All right. When it comes to Mamdani, we already see that he has the same people as Bill de Blasio and a lot of his cabinet. And he's already been gotten by the Our Revolution / Middle Seat / Leaders We Deserve people.
Yeah.
Now, I get Leaders We Deserve and Middle Seat confused sometimes. I'm going to make it very clear. Middle Seat is a progressive woke worker washing campaign that has millions of dollars going through it to do it. Now, I'm going to say this.
Consultancy, right? It's a consultancy group.
It's a consultancy that came out of Bernie's Our Revolution movement. It's a $1 million industry. And I say that's not actually a lot for politics. The reason why I say it, though, is that it indicates that the same elite capture that people complained about with the social justice movement, Freddie DeBoer, and people complained about with identity politics, Ofume Taiwo, Ofume Otaiwo, because there's two Ofume Taiwos. But it's happening to progressivism too. And it has to.
Hmm.
Right? Why have all of a sudden, it's not just Matt Brunig and you know, are these former Harvard people who put books out at Oxford University claiming to be Bernie socialists, like Sam Hasselbeck over at Aon or Matt Stoller or you see more and more of this. That is the same fucking elite capture that you saw in right populism and that you saw in identity politics. And also, if we're completely honest, capture is not the right word. All right, elite recuperation, because the elite battle was part of it from the beginning. So the more you succeed in the Democratic Party with this tactic, the more you have the same people who used to be on the other side on your side. Now, that's maybe progressive. I'm not saying it's totally not. But what I'm telling you is I want to look at like the policies proposed by left populists. All right. What are they? All right. And the national level is Medicare for all, maybe the Green New Deal.
Mm. Mass transit funding. I don't know.
Mass transit funding. Building more houses, maybe. Free college, although people are backing off on that.
Yeah.
I'm going to just tell you, those don't actually, by and large, necessarily solve the problems they're set out to solve. Free college, we'll start with that one. In Europe and Latin America and parts of Asia where they do it, it helps the rich.
Mm.
If they allow private universities to exist, middle class and poor people use the private sector, the rich use the public sector, because the rich can have the resources to get into those schools.
Mm.
That's a fact. There's study after study and study that proves it. People ignore it. All right. Because the problem of education does not happen in college, you dipshits. It happens in elementary school.
Mm.
Two. Medicare for all would be beneficial to everyone, but when people talk about it solely in terms of like, oh, it, by what we're paying the interest, we could fund Medicare for all. You can fund the program, if you assume cost and everything, are the same as they exist right now.
Mm.
But you are not dealing with any
Medicare and Medicaid that they're, you know, there's problems with containing costs, right?
Not just problems with containing costs. I mean, if you look at like what happens in the places that do have socialized medicine, that like the most socialized healthcare system on earth isn't even in China; it's in fucking Britain.
Mm.
All right, it has problems. It is way better than ours. The British live longer than we do. I'm not here to promote American propaganda, but it is constantly under threat of neoliberalization. It is constantly under the threat of breakage, and it is constantly underfunded.
Mm.
All right. Period. Now, why? Right. Well, one, it still has market costs. It's not, you can't socialize one part of the system and not deal with the other parts of the system. So it's got to buy stuff at market cost. It's got to compete on a labor market. It's got to do these things. Secondly, there's going to be, if you have to fund your bond market through taxation and you don't have hegemony to make people buy your goods, you actually can't just print money infinitely, and taxation does really matter.
Mm.
So that is why countries like Canada do actually have to fund they don't just print money for their public healthcare sector. And they also put it in the areas of government, province level, that don't have currency sovereignty to protect their bond markets, just like we're trying to do here. So you can't print, you can't really inflate the currency. That's a national decision, but the management of a lot of the provincial of the national healthcare services in Canada are provincially funded, just like in America. So yeah. Well, we don't fund our healthcare, but you get what I mean. Like, it's federated.
And that's like a built-in austerity. Is that what you're arguing?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. It's a built-in austerity. Mm-mm. The other thing is, two things would disappear if you federalized the markets. It didn't happen when all the other major powers did it, because these mechanisms weren't allowed to develop bureaucracies and entire internal economies around them. One, Gabriel Renat is white. Is right that the deindustrialized cities in the upper Midwest and in parts of New England are largely now supported by healthcare that was initially provided by Fordist compromises through these companies with their spouses. But if you got rid of those now, the only valve for a lot of people out of poverty would go away.
Mm.
You need more nurses, right? But you have trouble incentivizing doctors now. Mm. And all these supplementary things to nurses, we wouldn't have them. They're part of the cost disease of our system. Mm. Which would mean all kinds of basically women in positions related to hair care was the only part of our economy that's growing, which the Big Beautiful Bill will finish taking out in 2026. Mm. Which is why the Democrats have made it such a focus. Mm. It is not just out of the kindness of their hearts that they're doing that. It's because it's like the only engine of middle-class economic growth that exists. And if you want to deal with the cost saving that comes with making healthcare public, you're going to have to deal with all that infrastructure being irrelevant. It's a sunk cost problem.
Right.
And people don't want to look at it. So when they look at, they just think, if you paid the healthcare premiums, this is what it would cost. No, you are not looking downstream, right? This is why piecemeal socialism does not work.
Thank you. Thank you. I want to go into the second half of this. I would like to go into the paywalled section. I feel like kaleidoscopic, impressionistic, meandering, some might call it, but I feel like we've had a great conversation so far. If you want to hear the rest of it, become a patron of Derek at patreon.com/varnblog, and you can watch the video of this. You can actually watch us gesticulating. You can see the thumbs up that Varn is giving me as I say these things. If you want to simply hear it and also get our bonus content, patreon.com/ is it this wreckage now? I think it's this wreckage. I think we've done it. Maybe if you went to Antifa, it would still come up, but try this wreckage. Anyways, folks, we'll see you on the other side. Thank you so much for listening.